I never had a chance, said Lee Hunsacker. He sat in the middle of the kitchen at a table cluttered with papers. He needed a shave. His shirt needed laundering. It was hard to judge his age. The swollen flesh of his face looked smooth and blank, untouched by experience. The graying hair and filmy eyes looked worn by exhaustion. He was 42. Nobody ever gave me a chance. I hope they're satisfied with what they've made of me. But don't think that I don't know it. I know I was cheated out of my birthright. Don't let them put on any airs about how kind they are. They're a stinking bunch of hypocrites. Who? Asked Dagny. Everybody, said Lee Hunsacker. People are bastards at heart, and it's no use pretending otherwise. Justice? Ha! Look at it. His arms swept around him. A man like me reduced to this. Beyond the window, the light of noon looked like grayish dusk among the bleak roofs and naked trees of a place that was not country and could never quite become a town. Dusk and dampness seemed soaked into the walls of the kitchen. A pile of breakfast dishes lay in the sink. A pot of stew simmered on the stove, emitting steam with the greasy odor of cheap meat. A dusty typewriter stood among the papers on the table. The 20th Century Motor Company, said Lee Hunsacker, was one of the most illustrious names in the history of American industry. I was the president of that company. I owned that factory. But they wouldn't give me a chance.
You were not the president of the 20th Century Motor Company, were you? I believe you headed a corporation called Amalgamated Service?
Yes, yes, but it's the same thing. We took over their factory. We were going to do just as well as they did. Better. We were just as important. Who the hell was Jed Starnes, anyway? Nothing but a backwoods garage mechanic. Did you know that's how he started? Without any background at all. My family once belonged to the New York 400. My grandfather was a member of the National Legislature. It's not my fault that my father couldn't afford to give me a car of my own when he sent me to school. All the other boys had cars. My family name was just as good as any of theirs. When I went to college...
He broke off abruptly.
What newspaper did you say you're from?
She had given him her name. She did not know why she now felt glad that he had not recognized it, and why she preferred not to enlighten him. I did not say I was from a newspaper, she answered. I need some information on that motor factory for a private purpose of my own, not for publication.
Oh.
He looked disappointed. He went on sullenly, as if she were guilty of a deliberate offense against him.
I thought maybe you came for an advance interview because I'm writing my autobiography.
He pointed to the papers on the table.
And what I intend to tell is plenty. I intend... Oh, hell, he said suddenly, remembering something.
He rushed to the stove, lifted the lid off the pot, and went through the motions of stirring the stew, hatefully, paying no attention to his performance. He flung the wet spoon down on the stove, letting the grease drip into the gas burners, and came back to the table.
Yeah, I'll write my autobiography, if anybody ever gives me a chance, he said. How can I concentrate on serious work when this is the sort of thing I have to do?
He jerked his head at the stove.
Friends, ha! Those people think that just because they took me in, they can exploit me like a Chinese coolie. It's because I had no other place to go. They have it easy, those good old friends of mine. He never lifts a finger around the house, just sits in his store all day, a lousy little two-bit stationery store. Can it compare in importance with the book I'm writing? And she goes out shopping and asks me to watch her damn stew for her. She knows that a writer needs peace and concentration, but does she care about that?
Do you know what she did today? He leaned confidentially across the table, pointing at the dishes in the sink.
She went to the market and left all the breakfast dishes there and said she'd do them later. I know what she wanted. She expected me to do them. Well, I'll fool her. I'll leave them just where they are.
Would you allow me to ask you a few questions about the motor factory?
Don't imagine that that motor factory was the only thing in my life. I'd held many important positions before. I was prominently connected at various times with enterprises manufacturing surgical appliances, paper containers, men's hats, and vacuum cleaners. Of course, that sort of stuff didn't give me much scope. But the motor factory, that was my big chance. That was what I'd been waiting for.
How did you happen to acquire it?
It was meant for me. It was my dream come true. The factory was shut down, bankrupt. The heirs of Jed Starnes had run it into the ground pretty fast. I don't know exactly what it was, but there had been something goofy going on up there, so the company went broke. The railroad people closed their branch line. Nobody wanted the place. Nobody would bid on it. But there it was, this great factory with all the equipment, all the machinery, all the things that had made millions for Jed Starnes. That was the kind of setup I wanted, the kind of opportunity I was entitled to. So I got a few friends together, we formed the Amalgamated Service Corporation, and we scraped up a little money, but we didn't have enough. We needed a loan to help us out and give us a start. It was a perfectly safe bet. We were young men embarking on great careers, full of eagerness and hope for the future. But do you think anybody gave us any encouragement? They did not. Not those greedy, entrenched vultures of privilege. How were we to succeed in life if nobody would give us a factory? We couldn't compete against the little snots who inherit whole chains of factories, could we? Weren't we entitled to the same break? Don't let me hear anything about justice. I worked like a dog trying to get somebody to lend us the money. But that bastard Midas Mulligan put me through the ringer.
She sat up straight. Midas Mulligan?
Yeah, the banker who looked like a truck driver, and acted it, too.
Did you know Midas Mulligan?
Did I know him? I'm the only man who ever beat him. Not that it did me any good.
At odd moments, with a sudden sense of uneasiness, she had wondered, as she wondered about the stories of deserted ships found floating at sea, or of sourceless lights flashing in the sky, about the disappearance of Midas Mulligan. There was no reason why she felt that she had to solve these riddles, except that they were mysteries which had no business being mysteries. They could not be causeless, yet no known cause could explain them. Midas Mulligan had once been the richest, and consequently the most denounced man in the country. He had never taken a loss on any investment he made. Everything he touched turned into gold.
"It's because I know what to touch," he said.
Nobody could grasp the pattern of his investments. He rejected deals that were considered flawlessly safe, and he put enormous amounts into ventures that no other banker would handle. Through the years, he had been the trigger that had sent unexpected, spectacular bullets of industrial success shooting over the country. It was he who had invested in Reardon Steel at its start, thus helping Reardon to complete the purchase of the abandoned steel mills in Pennsylvania. When an economist referred to him once as an audacious gambler, Mulligan said,
"The reason why you'll never get rich is because you think that what I do is gambling."
It was rumored that one had to observe a certain unwritten rule when dealing with Midas Mulligan. If an applicant for a loan ever mentioned his personal need, or any personal feeling whatever, the interview ended, and he was never given another chance to speak to Mr. Mulligan.
"Why, yes, I can," said Midas Mulligan, when he was asked whether he could name a person more evil than the man with the heart closed to pity. "The man who uses another's pity for him as a weapon."
In his long career he had ignored all the public attacks on him, except one. His first name had been Michael. When a newspaper columnist of the humanitarian clique nicknamed him Midas Mulligan, and the tag stuck to him as an insult, Mulligan appeared in court and petitioned for a legal change of his first name to Midas. The petition was granted. In the eyes of his contemporaries, he was a man who had committed the one unforgivable sin. He was proud of his wealth. These were the things Dagny had heard about Midas Mulligan. She had never met him. 7 years ago, Midas Mulligan had vanished. He left his home one morning and was never heard from again. On the next day, the depositors of the Mulligan Bank in Chicago received notices requesting that they withdraw their funds because the bank was closing. In the investigations that followed, it was learned that Mulligan had planned the closing in advance and in minute detail. His employees were merely carrying out his instructions. It was the most orderly run on a bank that the country ever witnessed. Every depositor received his money down to the last fraction of interest due. All of the bank's assets had been sold piecemeal to various financial institutions. When the books were balanced, it was found that they balanced perfectly, to the penny. Nothing was left over. The Mulligan Bank had been wiped out. No clue was ever found to Mulligan's motive, to his personal fate, or to the many millions of his personal fortune. The man and the fortune vanished as if they had never existed. No one had had any warning about his decision, and no events could be traced to explain it. If he had wished to retire, people wondered, why hadn't he sold his establishment at a huge profit, as he could have done, instead of destroying it? There was nobody to give an answer. He had no family, no friends. His servants knew nothing. He had left his home that morning as usual, and did not come back. That was all. There was, Dagny had thought uneasily for years, a quality of the impossible about Mulligan's disappearance. It was as if a New York skyscraper had vanished one night, leaving nothing behind but a vacant lot on a street corner. A man like Mulligan, and a fortune such as he had taken along with him, could not stay hidden anywhere. A skyscraper could not get lost. It would be seen rising above any plain or forest chosen for its hiding place. Were it destroyed, even its pile of rubble could not remain unnoticed. But Mulligan had gone. And in the 7 years since, in the mass of rumors, guesses, theories, Sunday supplement stories, and eyewitnesses who claimed to have seen him in every part of the world, no clue to a plausible explanation had ever been discovered. Among the stories, there was one so preposterously out of character that Dagny believed it to be true. Nothing in Mulligan's nature could have given anyone ground to invent it. It was said that the last person to see him on the spring morning of his disappearance was an old woman who sold flowers on a Chicago street corner by the Mulligan Bank. She related that he stopped and bought a bunch of the year's first bluebells. His face was the happiest face she had ever seen. He had the look of a youth starting out into a great, unobstructed vision of life lying open before him. The marks of pain and tension, the sediment of years upon a human face, had been wiped off, and what remained was only joyous eagerness and peace. He picked up the flowers, as if on a sudden impulse, and he winked at the old woman, as if he had some shining joke to share with her. He said,
"Do you know how much I've always loved it? Being alive."
She stared at him, bewildered, and he walked away, tossing the flowers like a ball in his hand. A broad, straight figure in a sedate, expensive businessman's overcoat, going off into the distance against the straight cliffs of office buildings, with the spring sun sparkling on their windows.
"Midas Mulligan was a vicious bastard with a dollar sign stamped on his heart," said Lee Hunsacker in the fumes of the acrid stew. "My whole future depended upon a miserable $500,000, which was just small change to him. But when I applied for a loan, he turned me down flat, for no better reason than that I had no collateral to offer. How could I have accumulated any collateral when nobody had ever given me a chance at anything big? Why did he lend money to others but not to me? It was plain discrimination. He didn't even care about my feelings. He said that my past record of failures disqualified me for ownership of a vegetable pushcart, let alone a motor factory. What failures? I couldn't help it if a lot of ignorant grocers refused to cooperate with me about the paper containers. By what right did he pass judgment on my ability? Why did my plans for my own future have to depend upon the arbitrary opinion of a selfish monopolist? I wasn't going to stand for that. I wasn't going to take it lying down. I brought suit against him."
"You did what?"
"Oh, yes," he said proudly. "I brought suit. I'm sure it would seem strange in some of your hidebound eastern states, but the state of Illinois had a very humane, very progressive law under which I could sue him. I must say it was the first case of its kind, but I had a very smart liberal lawyer who saw a way for us to do it. It was an economic emergency law, which said that people were forbidden to discriminate for any reason whatever against any person in any matter involving his livelihood. It was used to protect day laborers and such. But it applied to me and my partners as well, didn't it? So we went to court and we testified about the bad breaks we'd all had in the past, and I quoted Mulligan saying that I couldn't even own a vegetable pushcart.
and we proved that all the members of the Amalgamated Service Corporation had no prestige, no credit, no way to make a living, and therefore the purchase of the motor factory was our only chance of livelihood, and therefore Midas Mulligan had no right to discriminate against us, and therefore we were entitled to demand a loan from him under the law.
Oh, we had a perfect case, all right.
But the man who presided at the trial was Judge Narragansett, one of those old-fashioned monks of the bench who thinks like a mathematician and never feels the human side of anything. He just sat there all through the trial like a marble statue, like one of those blindfolded marble statues. At the end, he instructed the jury to bring in a verdict in favor of Midas Mulligan, and he said some very harsh things about me and my partners. But we appealed to a higher court, and the higher court reversed the verdict and ordered Mulligan to give us the loan on our terms. He had 3 months in which to comply. But before the 3 months were up, something happened that nobody can figure out, and he vanished into thin air, he and his bank. There wasn't an extra penny left of that bank to collect our lawful claim. We wasted a lot of money on detectives trying to find him, as who didn't? But we gave it up. No, thought Dagny. No. Apart from the sickening feeling it gave her, this case was not much worse than any of the other things that Midas Mulligan had borne for years. He had taken many losses under laws of a similar justice, under rules and edicts that had cost him much larger sums of money. He had borne them, and fought, and worked the harder. It was not likely that this case had broken him. What happened to Judge Narragansett? She asked involuntarily, and wondered what subconscious connection had made her ask it. She knew little about Judge Narragansett, but she had heard and remembered his name, because it was a name that belonged so exclusively to the North American continent. Now she realized suddenly that she had heard nothing about him for years.
Oh, he retired, said Lee Hunsacker.
He did? The question was almost a gasp.
Yeah.
When?
Oh, about 6 months later.
What did he do after he retired?
I don't know. I don't think anybody's heard from him since.
He wondered why she looked frightened. Part of the fear she felt was that she could not name its reason either. Please tell me about the motor factory, she said with effort.
Well, Eugene Lawson of the Community National Bank in Madison finally gave us a loan to buy the factory, but he was just a messy cheapskate. He didn't have enough money to see us through. He couldn't help us when we went bankrupt. It was not our fault. We had everything against us from the start. How could we run a factory when we had no railroad? Weren't we entitled to a railroad? I tried to get them to reopen their branch line, but those damn people, the Taggart Trends...
He stopped.
Say... Are you by any chance one of those Taggarts?
I'm the operating vice president of Taggart Transcontinental. For a moment he stared at her in blank stupor. She saw the struggle of fear, obsequiousness, and hatred in his filmy eyes. The result was a sudden snarl.
I don't need any of you big shots. Don't think I'm going to be afraid of you. Don't expect me to beg for a job. I'm not asking favors of anybody. I bet you're not used to hear people talk to you this way, are you?
Mr. Hunsacker, I will appreciate it very much if you will give me the information I need about the factory.
You're a little late getting interested. What's the matter, your conscience bothering you? You people let Jed Starnes grow filthy rich on that factory, but you wouldn't give us a break. It was the same factory. We did everything he did. We started right in manufacturing the particular type of motor that had been his biggest moneymaker for years. And then some newcomer nobody ever heard of opened a two-bit factory down in Colorado by the name of Nielsen Motors and put out a new motor of the same class as the Starnes model at half the price. We couldn't help that, could we? It was all right for Jed Starnes. No destructive competitor happened to come up in his time, but what were we to do? How could we fight this Nielsen when nobody had given us a motor to compete with his?
Did you take over the Starnes Research Laboratory?
Yes, yes, it was there. Everything was there.
His staff, too?
Oh, some of them. A lot of them had gone while the factory was closed.
His research staff?
They were gone.
Did you hire any research men of your own?
Yes, yes, some.
But let me tell you, I didn't have much money to spend on such things as laboratories when I never had enough funds to give me a breathing spell. I couldn't even pay the bills I owed for the absolutely essential modernizing and redecorating which I'd had to do. That factory was disgracefully old-fashioned from the standpoint of human efficiency. The executive offices had bare plaster walls and a dinky little washroom. Any modern psychologist will tell you that nobody could do his best in such depressing surroundings. I had to have a brighter color scheme in my office, and a decent modern bathroom with a stall shower. Furthermore, I spent a lot of money on a new cafeteria, and a playroom, and restroom for the workers. We had to have morale, didn't we? Any enlightened person knows that man is made by the material factors of his background, and that a man's mind is shaped by his tools of production. But people wouldn't wait for the laws of economic determinism to operate upon us. We never had a motor factory before. We had to let the tools condition our minds, didn't we? But nobody gave us time.
Can you tell me about the work of your research staff?
Oh, I had a group of very promising young men, all of them guaranteed by diplomas from the best universities. But it didn't do me any good. I don't know what they were doing. I think they were just sitting around eating up their salaries.
Who is in charge of your laboratory?
Hell, how can I remember that now?
Do you remember any of the names of your research staff?
Do you think I had time to meet every hireling in person?
Did any of them ever mention to you any experiments with an entirely new kind of motor?
What motor? Let me tell you that an executive of my position does not hang around laboratories. I spent most of my time in New York and Chicago trying to raise money to keep us going.
Who was the general manager of the factory?
A very able fellow by the name of Roy Cunningham. He died last year in an auto accident. Drunk driving, they said.
Can you give me the names and addresses of any of your associates? Anyone you remember?
I don't know what's become of them. I wasn't in a mood to keep track of that.
Have you preserved any of the factory records?
I certainly have.
She sat up eagerly. Would you let me see them?
You bet.
He seemed eager to comply. He rose at once and hurried out of the room. What he put down before her when he returned was a thick album of clippings. It contained his newspaper interviews and his press agent's releases.
I was one of the big industrialists, too, he said proudly. I was a national figure, as you can see. My life will make a book of deep human significance. I'd have written it long ago if I had the proper tools of production.
He banged angrily upon his typewriter.
I can't work on this damn thing. It skips spaces. How can I get any inspiration and write a bestseller with a typewriter that skips spaces?
Thank you, Mr. Hunsacker, she said. I believe this is all you can tell me. She rose. You don't happen to know what became of the Starnes heirs?
Ah, they ran for cover after they'd wrecked the factory. There were three of them, two sons and a daughter. Last I heard, they were hiding their faces out in Durant's, Louisiana.
The last sight she caught of Lee Hunsacker as she turned to go was his sudden leap to the stove. He seized the lid off the pot and dropped it to the floor, scorching his fingers and cursing. The stew was burned. Little was left of the Starnes' fortune, and less of the Starnes' heirs.
You won't like having to see them, Miss Taggart, said the chief of police of Durant's, Louisiana.
He was an elderly man with a slow, firm manner, and a look of bitterness, acquired not in blind resentment, but in fidelity to clear-cut standards.
There's all sorts of human beings to see in the world. There's murderers and criminal maniacs. But somehow I think these Starnes persons are what decent people shouldn't have to see. They're a bad sort, Miss Taggart. Clammy and bad. Yes, they're still here in town. Two of them, that is. The third one is dead. Suicide. That was 4 years ago. It's an ugly story. He was the youngest of the three, Eric Starnes. He was one of those chronic young men who go around whining about their sensitive feelings when they're well past 40. He needed love, was his line. He was being kept by older women when he could find them. Then he started running after a girl of 16, a nice girl who wouldn't have anything to do with him.
She married a boy she was engaged to. Eric Starnes got into their house on the wedding night, and when they came back from church after the ceremony, they found him in their bedroom, dead. Messy dead. His wrists slashed. Now, I say there might be forgiveness for a man who kills himself quietly, who can pass judgment on another man's suffering and on the limit of what he can bear. But the man who kills himself, making a show of his death in order to hurt somebody, the man who gives his life for malice, there's no forgiveness for him. No excuse. He's rotten clear through, and what he deserves is that people spit at his memory instead of feeling sorry for him and hurt as he wanted them to be. Well, that was Eric Starnes. I can tell you where to find the other two, if you wish. She found Gerald Starnes in the ward of a flophouse. He lay half-twisted on a cot. His hair was still black, but the white stubble of his chin was like a mist of dead weeds over a vacant fence. He was soggy drunk. A pointless chuckle kept breaking his voice when he spoke, the sound of a static, unfocused malevolence. It went bust, the great factory. That's what happened to it, just went up and bust. Does that bother you, madame? The factory was rotten. Everybody is rotten. I'm supposed to beg somebody's pardon, but I won't. I don't give a damn. People get fits trying to keep up the show when it's all rot, black rot, the automobiles, the buildings, and the souls, and it doesn't make any difference one way or another. You should have seen the kind of literati who turned flip-flops when I whistled when I had the dough. The professors, the poets, the intellectuals, the world-savers, and the brother-lovers. Anyway, I whistled. I had lots of fun. I wanted to do good, but now I don't. There isn't any good. Not any goddamn good in the whole goddamn universe. I don't propose to take a bath if I don't feel like it, and that's that. If you want to know anything about the factory, ask my sister. My sweet sister, who had a trust fund they couldn't touch. So she got out of it safe, even if she's in the hamburger class now, not the filet mignon à la sauce béarnaise. But would she give a penny of it to her brother? The noble plan that busted was her idea as much as mine, but will she give me a penny? Ha! Go take a look at the Duchess, take a look. What do I care about the factory? It was just a pile of greasy machinery. I'll sell you all my rights, claims, and title to it. For a drink. I'm the last of the Starnes' name. It used to be a great name, Starnes. I'll sell it to you. You think I'm a stinking bum, but that goes for all the rest of them, and for rich ladies like you, too. I wanted to do some good for humanity. Ha! I wish they'd all boil in oil. Be lots of fun. I wish they'd choke. What does it matter? What does anything matter? On the next cot, a white-haired, shriveled little tramp turned in his sleep, moaning. A nickel clattered to the floor out of his rags. Gerald Starnes picked it up and slipped it into his own pocket. He glanced at Dagny. The creases of his face were a malignant smile. "Want to wake him up and start trouble?" he asked. "If you do, I'll say that you're lying." The ill-smelling bungalow where she found Ivy Starnes stood on the edge of town by the shore of the Mississippi. Hanging strands of moss and clots of waxy foliage made the thick vegetation look as if it were drooling. The too many draperies hanging in the stagnant air of a small room had the same look. The smell came from undusted corners and from incense burning in silver jars at the feet of contorted oriental deities. Ivy Starnes sat on a pillow like a baggy Buddha. Her mouth was a tight little crescent, the petulant mouth of a child demanding adulation. On the spreading, pallid face of a woman past 50. Her eyes were two lifeless puddles of water. Her voice had the even, dripping monotone of rain. "I can't answer the kind of questions you're asking, my girl. The research laboratory, the engineers. Why should I remember anything about them? It was my father who was concerned with such matters, not I. My father was an evil man who cared for nothing but business. He had no time for love, only for money. My brothers and I lived on a different plane.
Our aim was not to produce gadgets, but to do good. We brought a great new plan into the factory. It was 11 years ago. We were defeated by the greed, the selfishness, and the base animal nature of men. It was